Welcome back, everyone. Hi, Dad. How are you doing today?
Very well, thanks, Wyn. Well, how are you doing, having lost three teeth last night or late yesterday?
Recently had a wisdom tooth operation, so this is going to be an interesting one. I'll try and speak as normally as I can. Might be a little bit slower than usual. I guess we'll try our best today. If I start slowing and dribbling, then, you know, there's a bit of a problem. But for now, we should be absolutely fine. So today, the topic of conversation is going to be surrounding China and America's military, specifically their Navy, although there can be aspects of the Air Force and the Army coming into play as well. But we're going to be examining China and America head-to-head, their naval power in the Pacific, the ramifications of that for the rest of the world, what it's looking like right now, what are the state of their navies right now, and what impact that could have on all of our futures. So let's get straight into it, Dad. I'm going to read you a quote here, and I just want you to tell me what you think about it. Without a strong military, it is impossible to have a strong nation. What do you think?
Absolutely accurate. In a world where threats abound today, especially, that has never been more true.
Well, that was said by Xi himself, and I think that is a poignant point to examine, given his stance on the issue. I think he truly believes that himself, and he himself has a huge personal investment in the Chinese military and Navy, going to a lot of meetings, a lot of Army training exercises, addressing the Army himself. He seems very invested in the Army and the Navy and the Air Force, much more so than previous Chinese leaders, which seems to be reflecting in their current state, which is an ever-growing military presence.
Well, you've got to remember that Mao would have been equally as interested because he came to power through a civil war, and the military was the medium and the mechanism that gave him victory. So Mao understood that. And we've got to remember what Mao did with that military after the civil war. And I always laugh when people say that China's a peaceful country. Let's just look at what it did for the next 20 years, going to war with everyone around it and its neighbors. It used its military muscle, like all systems after a civil war, to expand, and then it found there was a natural limit, and that limit came about through American power, which gradually became stronger as the Cold War peaked in 75, and they found themselves with a glass ceiling, and that glass ceiling was exemplified by their Taiwan Straits crisis in 1996, where they were desperate to basically attempt to go and reacquire Taiwan, and two carriers and an American Mew sailed through the Straits. And the humiliation was total, and they never forgot that. So everything that they've been doing since then is about meeting America with superior might to reverse that experience, which was an extension of the century of humiliation, as they think of it. And this was the moment of humiliation, 1996, and they put an awesome plan into operation. And we're seeing that plan almost 30 years later, slap bang in front of us, and we haven't really responded rapidly to it as the West, especially in America.
Talking about the might buildup, as you've just brought up, let's have a look at some of the numbers. So currently, as of this year, China is sitting at about, in its Navy specifically, 350 ships and submarines. 130 of those are major surface warships. And that is compared to the US's approximately 300 ships. Having said that, the US does have a quarter of the world's aircraft carriers and seems to have a significant advantage in submarine warfare. Examining some other parts of their militaries, America has an air force comprising of 660,000 military personnel and a million strong army, whereas China has 400,000 in their air force, 2.5 million in their army, and 300,000 in their navy, which contrasts to actually the larger US navy, which is at 700,000. So we seem to be seeing China focusing manpower-wise, other parts of its military, but proportionally speaking, the US has a much higher proportion of service members in the Navy compared to the other two when equated to China. And that could be an interesting insight to the US strategy in dealing with China. What do you think?
Look, first of all, America took over the baton of Pax Britannica and created Pax America. The Second World War ended and had the most powerful Navy in the world. And carriers were its instrument of power projection across the oceans. And that legacy has continued up until, I would say, a few years ago. And suddenly, the manifestation of the Chinese challenge is coming to the fore, which we'll talk about. So for China, its issue is Canada eject America from what it calls the second island chain, even the third island chain, which is sort of the sphere of influence the Japanese had at the peak of their empire in the war, and essentially could it eject them so that it becomes a Chinese-controlled region, forcing everyone in that sphere to become Chinese or affiliated or owned by the Chinese empire. And to do that, it created a rather unique strategy. Its problem was essentially American carriers coming up to its coastline, somewhere about 600 miles away, and cycling 220 missions a day and pummeling it into dust because its aircraft and its technology was superior. And that was basically 10 years ago, if you talked about a power balance along with American submarines, the essence of how China would have succumbed to America. So they came up with an access area denial strategy. And the first part we saw was the building of the island chain fortifications below the low water mark and, you know, against the UNCLOS rules. But those fortifications that Obama essentially allowed to happen with the beginning of the pushout, every alarm bell should have been ringing at that stage. And there is always a process where a hegemonic system or challenge takes place where the hegemon's had decades to build its power structure. And the challenger comes up with asymmetric power and weapon systems, which are designed to overturn that power structure because it can't compete, doesn't have time to go and build out its Navy or Air Force or military in the same way. So the first advent of hypersonic weapons and the first advent use of ballistic missiles, which could then target, initially without hypersonic warheads, could target American carrier groups, was there a real wake-up call that they were coming for carrier power and they were coming to ablate American power in the region. And subsequent to that, their key element is basic ballistic missile systems with hypersonic glide weapons that can saturate the defenses of a carrier escort group, even if it's consolidated to the point where they cannot be defended. And that means America can't operate, or Japan, really, in its neighborhood, in the region where these weapons now project power. And that's the big shift we've really seen. If push came to shove, America would be ejected from the second island chain in a very short order. The other part of the equation is quality. And obviously, we tended to think 20 years ago the Chinese copied, but thanks to giving them our industrial base and exporting it and our IP, their technology base is our technology base, give or take a few strands that have been kept away from them that they haven't stolen. So if you look at the Type 55 destroyer, which is their latest big, so 12,000-ton ship, it's bigger than a Tricondra-class cruiser. It's essentially got similar technology as the Aegis system, Arleigh Burke's. So it's a highly capable platform, on top of which it now has the capability, or will soon have, to launch ballistic missiles, which carry hypersonic glide weapons far further than any U.S. destroyer or cruiser can actually attack any other enemy. So there's some great roof as far as the Chinese are concerned. Their weaponry is really, really quite sophisticated. So you're looking at equal sophistication apart from on the ground and carrier-to-carrier capabilities. But that's okay, because all the Chinese are looking to do is destroy every carrier group, every warship, every airbase in the second island chain in a lightning strike, and then America has to fight its way in. And that will be just as hard as surviving within the second island chain when saturation weapons come to play. So that's the basis of their shift in power. And the other piece they have that's really concerning is that when you project power from the western coast of America, you need three ships for every one China has in terms of the travel time, the maintenance periods, all of the things that go with it. And so just look at those numbers. And
what about the forward basic at Guam, though?
Yeah, well, it still has the same effect. You're still having to project your forces forward, which means you need far more of them to have the same sustained capability that the Chinese have just operating within their coast structure out from the second island chain. So there's a lot going for the Chinese in that respect. What isn't going for them is their submarine capability. In their conventional submarines are pretty quiet, but their nuclear submarines are not, and their subsea capabilities are far below that, I'd say, at the moment, of the West. And one of the things I've been concerned about is, as Putin is under stress, he trades Russian subsea technology, which is almost as good as ours, for something he wants. And we've got to assume that technology has now been transferred to China, and things like the Yasin boats you know, or the SEVs, as they're called in the submarine service, that are, at least when they start off, quiet, because after 3 or 4 years, they can't clean the reactor pipes and they become a bit noisy, as the first one has become, and it can now be tracked, but it couldn't before that moment. So essentially, we've got to assume the Chinese now have nuclear technology that's comparable to ours, and they'll be implementing that. Because what they also...
Do you not think that's a bit of a leap, though, Dad, just assuming that? Because you're not sure what they've shared.
No, but I think you can make some fairly good assumptions that somewhere in Putin's desperation, he would have traded one of his gems for something. So, and it's in his interest to see the Chinese start to swamp the US Navy. So, you know, those two countries have an allied purpose, and their enemy is the same enemy. So I think we've got to assume there's been that transfer.
If it does come to a conflict, how do you see the US Navy successfully combating long-range missiles from the Chinese mainland that are targeting carrier groups?
Unsuccessfully at the moment, which is the subject of Red Lightning. Basically, the limitations of interception are, let's just go and take a simple case, and let's just say that the DF-21s and 26s, which are the ballistic missile systems that Chinese would use, and let's just take a single carrier with two Arleigh Burkes and a Ticonderoga-class cruiser in escort, maybe a couple of submarines underneath. Doesn't matter in this case. They each have, the Arleigh Burkes have 96 Mark 41 tubes. So let's just take them, for example. Let's say they all have SM-6s, which are the ballistic missile-capable intercept systems. And their radars can track 28 of their SM-6s, track and guide, in the air at one time. And now, because they don't have a kill ratio of 100%, you have to put two missiles onto one target. And that means of the 28 SM-6s in the air at any one time, you're really hitting 14 targets. So let's assume that each destroyer can kill 14 incoming ballistic warheads that are non-hypersonic, the optimum case. So two of those and the same tracking system on Ticonderoga, that means anything above 3 times 14, you can do the numbers, 42 missiles, and the 43rd missile is going to kill a carrier. Now, that is a very sobering number, because we haven't even started talking about hypersonic weapons. What we're talking about is just saturating the defenses. And it's not something that aircraft can intercept, so you can't use your air wings in the way at the moment. I'm sure maybe in the future they'll reconfigure them. So let's just say 50 missiles, a carrier group, and the group disappears. Well, three carrier groups in the area, that's 150 missiles. They have multiples more than that. Add the glide weapons, and the whole thing becomes even more difficult.
Looking to the future, rather than immediate naval conflict at this current time, the shipbuilding capacity of China has clearly shown itself to be robust. Its fleet has increased tenfold in the past 30 years. It's been unbelievable.
That's accelerating. It's not as a linear curve.
Exactly. It's getting worse. But then contrast that to the US. They're having problems with their maintenance. They're having problems with their shipbuilding capacity. They're struggling to compete with the output of China. And in the long term, does that mean a weaker US Navy by 2027 when Xi says he wants to take Taiwan? At a time when he's going to take Taiwan and has made promises to, are the US Navy going to have the physical capacity to be able to resist them?
They don't have the capacity to resist them now because of these access area denial systems and the lack of modification of American weapon systems to compensate for the new paradigm. But in terms of, let's just say, they did, and then the initial stages were inconclusive. As you point out, the Chinese shipyards can build 100 major units a year in a wartime situation, and America can build 20. Now, let's assume that the shipyards of South Korea disappear too because of North Korea's success, and Japan can't make any ships. That in the whole industrial base, where so there is such capability, suddenly becomes, you know, non-functioning or pro-Chinese. And that is terrifying, because remember, how did the Allies win the Second World War? They literally built ships at a rate that the Japanese and Germans could never conceive of. And by the end of the war, the size of the American Navy was huge. And Britain, for example, had a shipbuilding system then, and it built an awful lot of warships too. And so did the Canadians. So everyone was building madly, and it was a race to build warships, which is why I am concerned, because I think if you're Chinese right now, you're looking at a series of optimum moments when you would seek to strike. No ability whatsoever to the idea that you've got, you can't defend your ships at the moment. You can't outbuild. You've got hypersonic weapons which are immune to interception, not like the Kinzhal in Russia. That's not like a hypersonic glide weapon. That's a very basic early form. These other ones go much faster and jig better, so they're harder to hit. And all in all, you've got Biden in office for another year you'd like to take advantage of. And your economy was designed after the pandemic to literally go on a war footing, to be far more import resources, less export, more independent. And that gap's created all sorts of economic issues. They're running out of time to act. And they look, and so I don't think they're going to act and win World War III altogether. They're going to reject America. America's going to have the problem of how it fights its way back in again. And in that period, they're going to consolidate and build ships and ships and ships until one day they can come out of the second island chain and start taking whole pieces off the globe and the map.
You've discussed a surprise strike, and that would take out a number of carriers that the US have. Having said that, they do have 11 or 12 aircraft carriers, so yep. Could they not bring more force to bear on the Western Pacific, whereas the Chinese only have two, I mean, a new one that they're coming through with, but two reasonably old aircraft carriers to combat that with. So in a prolonged war, after this first strike, what happens then?
Okay, so running through the scenarios of the Chinese can't go toe-to-toe in a conventional naval battle, let's say remove the Axis aerial denial missiles, let's just put them aside and say, okay, toe-to-toe, could the Chinese do it against America, this Pacific fleet? Add the Japanese in, very unlikely. Not going to happen, superiority of almost, 3-2, even higher, slightly. And then you look at the next bit, is what happens when Russia is also now engaged in this war in the Atlantic, and its submarines are going to be formidable and be a challenge. Although I think, they will ultimately be beaten. The problem for the Russian Navy is the moment that happens, all of their ships in Murmansk and the Kola Peninsula, all the bases they operate from are going to get quickly severed because of the proximity of Finland and Finland's ability to sever one road in and out, and the fact that, NATO aircraft could pummel it so quickly. So sustained naval operations are not going to be possible in the North Atlantic beyond the first missions. And therefore, within 3 months, you can see Russia basically forced to retreat its forces to Vladivostok in the east, support the Chinese, and the Atlantic becoming relatively stable, allowing non-American craft to patrol it, and all American craft, as you probably say, to go and reinforce the Pacific, which puts a huge force to bear. But they still have the same problem, because given enough of these Axis aerial denial systems, you can saturate huge numbers of defenders if you coordinate. And that's the problem they face that we need to overcome. More missiles, better kill ratios. For example, if you go and look at the reason why Americans really like a Type 45 air defense destroyer, and let's put aside, the fact that you're talking about ballistic missile intercepts, but you're talking about just standard air defense, airplanes, missiles. The 48 missiles that the Sea Vipers, that the 45 carries, can be carried, fired all at once, and they're like almost a one-on-one kill ratio. So you don't fire two at a time, you fire one. So that ship can take out 48 incoming targets. And as we talked about, but it's 96x2, so it's a similar number, but it's in mass fires. So they're very capable ships, but again, we don't put enough missiles on them. I would argue their hulls weren't big enough. Should be carrying 200 silos, not 48. So things like that. We've left it a bit too late. We've been slow to understand the threat, and we're now in a very dangerous window indeed, where the Chinese, if they choose to act, and it's not their perfect moment. It's just like many hegemons, they just go at the best possible time they think they're going to get. And we've made that easier, or America has, and because they have, as you said, run down every part of their navy, their shipbuilding, their maintenance. The idea that their Ticondras are all want to be retired because they're so tired through lack of maintenance is mad when they carry 126 vertical launch Mach 41 and sitting there. And whereas that's versus 96 on an Ali Burt. Just when you most need them, they're looking like they're running out of juice. So now I think the US Navy has been really asleep. Like a system in decline, it's let itself decline.
Talking about the US Navy being asleep, what is your opinion of the Zumwalt class destroyer?
Well, look, the Zumwalt destroyers, I think, were a product of a period when you had this asymmetric warfare in the Middle East where American forces were blotting out and applying huge amounts of technology to killing what they were viewed to be Islamic terrorists or sources of danger. And the Navy really wanted to stay in the picture. So they created this sophisticated ship, a littoral combat ship that could come in close, even against a sophisticated enemy, wouldn't be on the radar screen, bombard its enemies cheaply with what they thought would be rail guns, and move away. And the problems with that are the rail gun system has failed totally. They haven't solved the metallurgical problem of how you keep the gun cool through multiple launches. So it's an assisted munition to, you know, maybe 98 miles rather than the 200 miles they thought was going to happen. These ships don't have integrated air defense systems like a standard US destroyer, so they're not really able to defend themselves once they're detected. They do have, you know, a large number of silos and cells which can be used, like 128, something like that, that can be used as land attack. But they do have some very sophisticated systems in operation that act as the basis for other vessels. But there's only three of them for a reason. They're expensive and they don't really have a purpose in the way that a fleet destroyer has, projecting a carrier or projecting power in the same way. So we'll see how stealthy they are and how effective they really are at sea. And their lack of self-defense, I think, is a little alarming.
Technologically speaking, do you believe the Chinese Navy currently possesses a capacity to combat effectively the Ali Burke class destroyers that the US Navy employs?
Look, I think the Type 55 is an equally capable warship with, if they put their ballistic weapon systems on, that, you know, carry a DF-21, like 1,500 miles, or a DF-26, 2,500 miles, actually has a multiple longer range than Ali Burke. I slightly think because the Ali Burks have gone through different blocks and flights and iterations, they're well and truly battle worthy and proven. And I probably would put my money on American sailors with a factor of two over Chinese sailors through their lack of combat capability initially. But make enough of them and they become a problem. And they're not that far different. And they close the gap and learn at a staggering rate. And I know that feedback from Russian submarine, you know, interactions is they learn at a staggering rate. So we cannot underestimate them. And we have to assume that they are not the Soviets. And, you know, the Soviets have proven, and they're not the Russians who've proven themselves to be lacking in some areas. Although even the Russians have finally got their act together in some acts of warfare. So no one likes to die. No one likes to lose. And adaptation is the name of the game. It's a question of how quickly you can do it. And the Chinese are very adaptive.
Going back to what you touched on earlier regarding Putin's involvement in a possible Western Pacific naval conflict, from what you said, I understood you to mean that despite the successes of Russia's submarines, overall, the Russian Navy would not swing the balance in the favor of a possible China-Russia alliance. Would you say that's true, yes or no?
Yeah, it is, because to be effective, they really need to have the ability to maintain North Atlantic naval operations, pin down and damage US and NATO assets that can't then be redeployed into the Pacific theater. And that was always going to be a tough call because they were outnumbered and their surface fleet wouldn't last very long. Their submarines would be harder to hunt, but they probably would be found and they would be hunted. But now that the Kola Peninsula is so vulnerable because of the proximity of Finland, the idea of sustained operations beyond the first 3 months of a war seems absolutely zero. So, no, I think Finland joining NATO has totally changed that balance.
In one of your recent pieces regarding this very topic, you drew attention to the problems that America would face in their supply lines and communication lines operating in the Western Pacific. Do you think that in a given conflict between these two Pacific navies, that the distance between America and its forward bases would neutralize any technological advantage it has?
It certainly makes things enormously logistically difficult. You know, war is about logistics, supplies. You know, ships have to steam into combat, then they loose off all the weapons, they're going to steam out again, they're going to resupplied. Distance makes that hugely more complicated, hugely. And that's not in America's favor in projecting power back in. So once they get kicked out, it's going to be quadruply harder to get back in again, as it was, for example, in the Second World War, with the sophistication of the whole campaign that went up from Australia in two particular forks to come round and pincer into Japan. It's a massive endeavor. You know, it is, and I think it's a very good model for the theater and what that theater might produce in a next war. But you know, the Pacific War and the Second World War is to be studied and understood because its lessons are still relevant.
Regarding the future of naval warfare, there's been discussion of drones. Several top U.S. naval intelligence officers have discussed this possibility. Do you see an increasing mechanization of top fleets around the world in general?
It's already happening. The Royal Navy, the U.S. Navy are creating independent AI submarines that can hunt and kill separate or work with maybe their parent submarine as a force multiplier.
And how does that change the balance of power, and how does that change warfare itself, in your opinion?
It allows for one of the problems the West has is mass, as we've seen in Ukraine. It is a huge war of the ilk of Stalingrad, and yet Western contributions of weapon systems has been significant, but not big enough to make it easy for the Ukrainians to regain their territory. So what these drones do is they create a substitute for mass by making, for example, a drone, autonomous submersible might only be 60 foot long, whereas, building a main submarine is a completely different endeavor. You can build those submersibles much quicker. And in fact, in Red Lightning, the first contact that, the battle fleet that survives has in the Big Lizzie, essentially, was with an astute and an operating drone system called HMS Alp that had picked up a Chinese submarine coming in through the Faroe Island gap and tailed it and understood its combat mission and in the end destroyed the submarine. So I think they are here right now. They're coming soon. And they are, part of the West dominance of the undersea domain. And I think it's very hard for the Chinese to really catch up in time for that. But it's one of the things we should be aware of, that if conflict doesn't break out immediately, it just gets stronger and stronger and stronger until one day in a conflict, we have no chance. At the moment, there are chances, though the initial strikes will be exceptionally painful. But and that's the problem, like Pearl Harbor. The initial strikes were disastrous, but America recovered. To what extent it's the same? Probably 50%, 30%. But, the Chinese, I think, might find themselves in a position where they execute that, and it will be total surprise. There will be no warnings for this to work. We will go from lovely, shiny faces from the CCP to Pearl Harbor all over again out of nowhere.
Well, I think that's a good note to end on. Thank you for your time, Dara. Thank you for your insight, as ever. How are you feeling after that?
Great. Good job, Wayne, especially from a man with three holes in his jaw.
Can't speak too loudly.
Resistant to codeine and its effects.
I'm trying my best. Well, thank you for listening, guys, and we'll see you on the next episode. David Murren specializes in using the past to predict the future, and is an accomplished public speaker, hedge fund manager, and market trader. To date, he's authored three books: Breaking the Code of History, Lions Led by Lions, and Now or Never. He also writes a blog on his website, www.davidmerrin.co.uk, where you can find more on his life, views, and work.